Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, as truthful as resources permit. My name's Jimmy and I voted Leave in the EU referendum in 2016.
And my name is Jazza and I'm bored. I'm bored of all of them. I can't be bloody arsed anymore. As a result of this week, we're not going to be talking about the election.
I'm sure at all. A lot of people have tuned in for our exquisite election coverage.
Exquisite is a word that no one's ever used about our podcast.
Probably, but they've tuned in expecting that, and we've already announced we're not providing them with it, so that they've angrily turned off.
So what I think is actually going to happen is that people are going to be really quite thankful that we are providing an update on things outside of the absolute shitstorm that is happening in the UK at the moment. Don't you agree?
Possibly. I do think you're endlessly overhyping the level of shitstormness that's taking place. I don't really think it's that bad.
I don't know. It's just really depressing me at the moment. And so I'd rather be depressed by other people's shit.
I see. Have you decided who you're going to vote for in your super safe Labour constituency?
I think we should save that for the next podcast, where we will finally talk about the election again.
Okay. Yeah, mm-hmm. Fine.
Does that sound, have you decided? Don't tell us who.
I have decided.
That's fine. Tender hooks. Make sure you're subscribed so you get to hear the next podcast.
This is assuming we actually managed to record another one and they're not waylaid in some way.
I don't know. We've done quite well. We've done two in a row.
Yeah, that is true, I think.
Yeah, very fun. So what are we going to talk about rather than the general hashtag GE2019?
I think we should start out with what's going on in Hong Kong, which you're definitely better placed to introduce than I am.
So, in Hong Kong, quite a lot of this year, kind of coming to a head really in June, in the summer, there have been a number of increasingly violent and extreme demonstrations and clashes between primarily student protesters, but also kind of proponents of the democracy movement in Hong Kong, who have been denied the chance for full democracy on the in the Chinese region. There's been a number of clashes between the police, who are backed by Beijing,
and the Hong Kongers, who are not backed by anyone,
who are backed by just themselves, but now also
Donald Trump,
kind of backed by Donald Trump. Whoopsie daisy. Is Donald Trump doing a single thing correctly? Perhaps.
But a broken clock is right twice a day.
That is fair. And maybe Hong Kong is just where that broken clock is correct. So there was a bill that was passed in the House of Representatives, the Human Rights and Democracy Act, where the US is going to continually review the status of Hong Kong as a place where trade is going to continue to be able to flow relatively freely compared to the rest, with the rest of China, where there's currently a trade war happening. Very exciting. But Donald Trump signed this into law and was quite diplomatic.
Yeah, gave a sensible statement.
Yeah, bless him.
So we're going to be talking about the repercussions associated with that. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. All that fun stuff. I think for the second topic, we should be discussing the fact that the I, which is the sort of...
It was previously the Independent.
No, the Independent is a different newspaper.
No, but like basically the same.
So the I was a spin-off from the Independent.
Yeah.
It's like a small, like 20p, well, it was 20p at
it
one
was,
stage,
yeah,
but,
yeah.
Newspaper that has since passed into the hands, briefly the hands of Johnston Press. And mm-hmm. now it's been sold off to the Daily Mail General Trust, which is the umbrella organisation for all of the Daily Mail papers, and they also have a stake in the Evening Standard.
Mm-hmm.
So, and Jeremy Corbyn has actually reacted to this by saying what a bad thing it is that the 5 of the 10 top newspapers, top print newspapers in the country, are now owned by just 2 different media groups, or media barons, effectively.
Oh, barons! Love the word baron.
I assume, so he's Viscount Robemare, is the sort of head honcho at the Daily Mail group.
What's a Viscount?
It's just a title. Like, it doesn't... It's not like...
Did it ever mean anything, or was it just a nice thing to put in front of somebody's name?
I don't really know, oh. I'm afraid. I'm not really up on my titles. Mm-hmm. I think the other one's probably Rupert Murdoch, I guess.
Yes, yeah.
Although the Telegraph's owned by the Barclay brothers.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the Guardian, the source of all that is pure and good in this world, is owned by a charity, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So
tongue firmly in cheek.
Yeah. I guess we're going to be talking about media ownership and whether Corbyn is right that mm-hmm. this is a gross betrayal of democracy.
Gross betrayal. But we're not allowed to talk about the election when we talk about it.
No. Corbyn will be referred to purely in his capacity as media critic.
Mm-hmm. And then finally, guys, I'm really excited because there's been Eurovision news. And Jimmy agrees that we should talk about this topic. Very, very, very happy. This was brought to our attention by somebody on Twitter who we'll name in the main body of the segment because I haven't got the tweet up at the moment. Basically Hungary, that fair country in Central Europe?
Central Europe.
Yeah, Central Europe.
Yeah.
Currently run by Viktor Orban.
Yeah.
Who's not very nice.
I think the Guardian probably describes him as far right, mm-hmm. which is fair in some.
The Right Dishonourable describes him as not very nice.
Not very nice.
Mm-hmm.
He has a programme on the go at the moment to effectively encourage traditional families, i.e. straight sex families,
mm-hmm.
To breed.
Straight sex?
Straight sex,
not.
Straight sex couples over a family.
Same sex? No.
Straight sex?
No, straight couples.
It's been a very long week. And the terminology is difficult.
Heterosexual couples.
Different sex couples.
Different sex couples.
Different sex couples.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go.
So I feel they got. But
yeah,
anyway,
that's nice.
he's a strange guy.
So it actually has nothing really to do with Viktor Orban, but there is a lot of government involvement with the public broadcaster who's decided to pull out of the Eurovision Song Contest. There was one media commentator who described it as too gay and said that that the Eurovision Song Contest was in fact a homosexual flotilla. I'm yet to see anything incorrect in their statements, to be honest.
I mean, it's not an actual flotilla. The flotilla mm-hmm. is just a metaphor for the, you know, the joy and the parading that
mm-hmm.
goes on
mm-hmm.
in the guise of Eurovision. I actually really don't like Eurovision, but it's not for the same reasons as this guy.
I just for the record, love it more than most people I know.
I think you love it more than most things.
Oh my, most things, full stop.
Yeah.
Life itself, even.
Yeah.
Right, we're going to go into the begging of the cash. Then carry on with the episode. Good?
If you enjoy what we do at this here podcast, you can support us by going onto our Patreon account. Jazza, where can they find our Patreon account?
Patreon.com.
/
Right Dishonourable. Well...
Or just Google Patreon, Right Dishonourable. So there you can just...
help us keep the podcast going. Christ, you're bad at this.
I'm so bad at
it. We need to say thank you to all of the people who are pledging to us on Patreon. It's very kind of them, isn't it?
I love that you just pulled those through.
I have. Absolutely terrible.
That's why we make you do it.
Right, so thank you to Andrew Kilpatrick.
Bence Ugray.
David Warner.
Emerson Spots.
Gemma Cumming.
Jono.
Oh, and Ollie McGregor.
And Matt. You missed out Matt.
I missed out Matt and Matt. Sorry,
you're,
Matt.
You're also bad. So
yeah. Okay, good. Yeah, but dyslexic, so I have an excuse. You don't.
I'm just bad at speaking.
Exactly. Right, we're going to get on for the episode now.
It's a real disability, yeah. Jazza, what's Hong Kong like at this time of year?
Oh, I can tell you.
Yes.
I was there quite recently
okay.
for like an 8-hour layover. So I left, had a little bit of a wander about, ate some dim sum, then got back on my flight.
Okay.
So I didn't get to see very much of the protesting that happened, but I did see some of the remnants. So there was some graffiti in the financial district talking about how Carrie Lam is the chief executive of Hong Kong, by the way, which is what they call their head of government.
Yeah.
It's a weird thing because Hong Kong is obsessed with business, but it's a quirk that I really quite love about the part of the world.
I guess like this, there's chief executives of councils in general, but like the City of London Corporation, which is effectively a council, has loads of weirdly named positions.
Yeah. So similar thing there. But Carrie Lam had a haircut recently. Big news. She's a Beijing shill, essentially. She's a bit of a puppet. Seems quite inept and incompetent by people on all parts of the Hong Kong spectrum. But somebody had a bit of graffiti that said, "Not a haircut, Carrie, but a head cut," suggesting the beheading of Carrie Lam.
That's actually quite sinister.
It is quite sinister, but I think it shows quite clearly how much people dislike her. Currently, there has been a standoff with protesters from the Chinese University of Hong Kong and the Polytechnic University with police, where they were forced, basically a weird cat and mouse game of the police trying to infiltrate the university to get people out, and then people hiding from the police, and lots of strange stuff. There's a lot of fear actually around especially the student population, with the severity of how they're going to be treated by the police in Hong Kong. Like prison awaits an awful lot of them. And like personally as well, this is a part of the world that I really, really like. Like, I used to live in China, and Hong Kong was like this weird kind of westernized bridge and oasis in a really quite chaotic part of the world. And it has stuff like British plugs, and they drive on the left,
and the post boxes
are the same, and all of that kind of, and they use S's in words like standardize rather than Z's like the Americans, and it's all of this like really, really lovely stuff about it that I love about Hong Kong.
Very specific detail.
And the people are fantastic. I love Hong Kongese people and Cantonese people, and it's just kind of like this desperation of it, really. Like, it's either a fight for the democracy that they have. Hong Kong has never had full democracy. Like, even when we were running the place for 99 years, we had the British owned Hong Kong for 99 years on lease, and then gave it back in 97.
It was only a portion of the island that was on lease. We had some of the island permanently owned by us.
Yes, yeah. So the island, I believe, was owned by us, but then the territories were on lease.
On lease, roughly speaking, yeah.
But they have kind of been raised in a much more liberal part of China than those who were raised under communist rule.
And it's more westernised.
Yeah, much more westernised, much more international than Beijing or Shanghai ever were. And that kind of promise that was given to them by the British, there was meant to be a 50-year, there was meant to be like a 20-year transition to full democracy. So 2017, they were meant to have fully democratic elections, and
that has not happened.
But
they do have district council elections.
Yes, they do.
And in the recent one, there was a 71% turnout, which is apparently high for these sort of elections, which I can believe because it's about councils. And 17 out of 18 of the seats went to effectively the anti-Beijing cohort, or at least the pro-democracy cohort, depending on how you want to phrase it. So, you know, it does seem that it's not just like a minority of vocal protesters, it is a general
thing. So there is some frustration with the protesters within Hong Kong and without Hong Kong as well. There was some footage of a Hong Kongese guy being like getting in an argument with some of the student protesters, and they covered him in flammable liquid and then set him on fire.
Committed GBH against him.
Right. Which not the most fun, and not the best look for the student protesters. And so there is a conflict of kind of like sentiment with the protesters and with the general residents, who do tend to be very, I am Hong Kongese before I am Chinese nowadays. If you poll them on identity, it used to be a lot more balanced, but now people feel much more Hong Kongese than they do Chinese. And whenever they partake in these elections, there do tend to be more of a tilt towards the pro, not independence, but anti-Beijing candidates.
Mm. Well, conflicts like this always tend to, you know, build up identities of, you know, smaller nations against bigger nations, or you know what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that surprising that the election has turned out that way, and actually Hong Kong identity has been strengthening since the Chinese took the territory back.
Mm-hmm. But there is this kind of sadness to the inevitability of it all, because China ain't going to back down.
Well, that's
the West isn't going to defend Hong Kong if China decides to invade.
Yeah, I mean, you know, at the end of one series of protests, it looked as though the Chinese military was going to sort of go into the island. They were sort of parking up trucks and stuff in football state.
Who was still there? Yeah.
I mean, ultimately, it does come down to power politics. If nobody is willing to defend Hong Kong's rights by violence, then, you know, what can they do fundamentally? Mm-hmm. But I think that's why the Trump thing is kind of interesting. I'm not suggesting the US is about to steam in, you know, with like an aircraft carrier or whatever, and, you know, defend Hong Kong that way. But I get, you know, it does count for something when the, you know, the world superpower, still the big superpower in the world, is willing to back you.
So Trump has kind of had his hands tied with it, though, because it passed so unanimously in the House of Representatives. It would have been difficult for him to veto this bill going through. And even if he had, because it was so overwhelmingly supported in the House, then this bill where the status of Hong Kong is reviewed again and again, like a statement has to be released, his veto would have probably meant nothing. And so he's decided to kind of like play the politics there of it, continues to say that Xi Jinping is like a great guy and all of that stuff.
I mean, you sort of have to, though. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously he's not a conventional diplomat in any sense of the word, but in the statement he released, which was, you know, very dry and sober by his standards, he said, you know, China's great, Xi Jinping is great.
Xi Jinping.
The Hong Kong is, you know, great. Everyone's great. This is sounding much more Trumpy than the actual statement was.
Yeah.
I assume that's how he read it out in his own head, at least.
Of course. He didn't read it. Jimmy, he can't read.
But, yeah, you know, he said, you know, hopefully they can resolve their differences amicably. But from Beijing's point of view, if Hong Kong gets what it, you know, if the Hong Kong people get what they want, that usually when you're running a very centralised autocratic system, you have this paranoia that if you give freedom to anyone, if you let anyone take an inch, it will just encourage other people to do likewise.
Yeah, right. And Xi has a tendency to be, he is the most centralised and probably authoritarian leader that they've had, at least since Deng Xiaoping, since like the 80s.
They've gone through some purges, haven't they?
Yeah, like the top levels of like the Communist Party are constantly kind of like jostling, and Xi is the most prominent of and the most kind of like powerful chairman and leader that they have had for a very, very long time. And he is kind of not only do you see this with Hong Kong, but you see it with his stances with Taiwan, for example. And also we see it with the Uyghur concentration camps as well in Xinjiang, where like thousands of Uyghur people who are from the Muslim minority are being re-educated.
It's like the
far west that borders all of the stands. Is very like oil rich, so it's a really important part of China for them, but has a Muslim minority there who not many of them necessarily speak Chinese particularly well, their Muslim religion is also kind of like being trained out of them. Like there's images that come out of a lot of the BBC reporting of this has been really good, actually. But images of like what were mosques now with kind of like all of the Arabic painted over, and the Chinese words for love the party, love your country, are put over the front of what would have been kind of like a religious thing.
And it is an ethnic cleansing that's going on there, basically.
The ethnic cleansing means there's, like, I feel like it means mass murder. There's
not
an attempt to culturally homogenise them.
Yeah. I mean, it can involve just deportations and that sort of
and
thing.
I'm sure there are people who have died and been killed. But it's, like, all of this is kind of like a repercussion of Xi's own policies.
Hmm. But this is the thing that concerns me about China's economic rise anyway, is that as China becomes more powerful and is willing to kind of stretch itself militarily and everything else.
We see it in the South China Sea.
It's you know, it's building islands in the South China Sea so it can install military bases there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We just had a load of sand. We needed to put it somewhere.
Yeah, and it's... But it... You know, you can't stop a country from doing that once it reaches a certain level of power. I mean, in the same way that the US is, you know, to some degree is unstoppable if it wants to do something.
Mm.
And, you know, whatever your criticisms of the US, it is generally much more amenable to our interests than the Chinese necessarily
fair.
Are.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the Hong Kong thing in some ways is a flashpoint for this. It's a flashpoint for the rise of China and the relative decline of the US.
Yeah, and you kind of see that, and China and the UK as well. Obviously, because we used to own the island and kind of like run the place, essentially. And you see this also with what you see in the China region of like this general decline of Hong Kong, which was kind of the pinnacle of the East. It was the crown of Asia, the best place to live, best place to like raise your kids and everything, in the whole of Asia in like the 90s. And you've seen it gradually get overtaken by its mainland rivals like Shanghai and Beijing, and even like Guangzhou and Shenzhen are now really like places that are more attractive to businesses and all of those kind of things. Hong Kong on a decline is just kind of like a really sad thing to see, because we have kind of just up and left and dumped it there, and we're not really doing very much on our end either.
But what could we do?
We could offer like permanent residency and citizenship to all of the British passport holders in Hong Kong. We could even extend asylum to political people who are under political persecution, for example. If I were in charge, that's what I'd bloody do, and it would piss off China. But like the Dalai Lama lives in India, and India and China are still able to have some kind of a relationship.
Yeah. So I mean, almost what you're talking about there is a kind of mass evacuation of the territory, really.
Possibly.
I'm not saying, I mean, there is a lot of appeal to that idea, but I, you know, fundamentally the British are not powerful enough to confront China in a larger sense than that.
No, not at all. But I think that we at least need to have those systems in place, because even British passport, Hong Kongese British passport holders do not have, they have the right to live here indefinitely, but they don't have the right to like work and claim benefits and have full citizens' rights in the UK. It's kind of like a complicated situation for them. And removing that ambiguity would probably be good, and maybe extending it to the likes of like the leaders of the movement and people who have been compromised by this kind of stuff. I mean, that's what I'd do, but no one's putting me anywhere near the seats of power for very good reasons.
Do you want to talk about the sale of the eye to the
Yeah, let's move on. Make me feel a little bit better. So, why shouldn't I worry about, what is it, 70 or 80% of the country's newspapers owned by two people?
No, it's the top, it's five out of the top 10 media. I mean, basically the newspaper.
So I just used gross hyperbole.
Well, I mean, fundamentally,
what 100% of the newspapers are owned by like Rupert Murdoch? Which is
sort of like, I mean, you know, Rupert Murdoch is obviously the richest, most billionaireist. I think he's the
most billionaireist.
Yeah, he's like that caricature of the evil media baron. For justified reasons.
Did he come first, or did the evil media baron caricature come first?
Well, actually, so Viscount Rovermere, I think it's his dad, or it might actually even be his granddad. I'm not that familiar, but basically, his one of his ancestors in who actually created the Daily Mail, he arguably is the the model for that kind of evil media billionaire, because he created it in the late 1800s, I think, and sort of realized that there was this huge appetite for what would now be called sort of yellow journalism, or like scandalous journalism. I guess that's one of the fears here, is that the Daily Mail obviously has a reputation for being
shit.
I wouldn't say shit. I mean, it has a reputation for, you know, having like being a good product, basically. It's well respected among journalists as a product, but people disapprove of its politics and of the moral values that it puts forward, because it's a very socially conservative newspaper, and it has a patchy record as far as, you know, covering minorities, be they sort of sexual or ethnic minorities, in a favourable way. So, but I don't think that's a problem here, because I think The Eye, which is a spin-off paper from The Independent, and was sold off when The Independent
was only founded in the 80s, right?
Yeah. And there was a point, I mean, that we can bring back Rupert Murdoch here. The Independent at one point competed with The Times, and Rupert Murdoch slashed the price of The Times, and is blamed, in certain readings, is blamed for actually permanently sort of hurting The Independent because of that, and stopping them from actually competing against The Times on a more level playing field, because it was just an independent, as the name implies, an independent newspaper competing against The Times.
Which is meant to be the paper of record.
Yeah,
kind of is the closest thing that we have to that. Like, it's the New York Times in the US.
Yeah.
And the Washington Post, I guess. And I feel like The Times is our... Or is our international audiences will know it. The Times of London.
Yeah, or the London Times. That is true, but that's just because it's the oldest newspaper that's still standing, I guess.
That's fair. Why is there such fear, do you think, then, about there being... so much of our national press in such a small number of hands? Like, is The Eye gonna like turn into the Daily Mail? Do you think they're just gonna fold it?
Why would they fold it?
It doesn't make money.
But why would you buy it just to fold it?
I don't know. It happens all the time.
You mean they sort of keep it going for a little while just to keep up appearances?
Yeah, I guess.
Well, I don't think The Eye really competes with The Mail as such. Like, the thing about The Eye is it's a very cheap newspaper, and it was launched for people who are, quote, time poor. So it's much slimmer. It has much less content than like a standard newspaper like The Times or The Guardian or whatever. But it is pitched towards that slightly more sophisticated audience at the same time, when compared to like The Express or The Sun. Not that I'm casting aspersions, but you know what I mean. I don't think that's the plan. I mean, I'm not really sure what's in it for the Daily Mail, to be honest with you, because, you know, if you look at something like News Corp, which is Rupert Murdoch's vehicle for owning all the British papers he does, there's various different like companies, and like it's nested in a weird way, but basically Rupert Murdoch makes most of his money out of broadcasting in the US and sort of stuff like film and other bits and pieces. He doesn't make good money on newspapers, because nobody makes good money on newspapers anymore. So, you know, a lot of them are kind of considered trophy assets. Like, even something like the Financial Times, which is a prestigious newspaper, there was a feeling that when Nikkei, which is a Japanese company, bought it, that it was buying it so that it could show it off to its friends, not because it was a good investment. And to some degree, the same logic applies with The Eye, but maybe there's some synergies or whatever that you can actually...
But I don't feel like The Eye is seen as a particularly good newspaper. It's a shadow, if that, of what The Independent used to be, which was, I think, quite a good newspaper back in the day when it like was able to do investigative journalism and write more than 100 words on an individual story. Like,
yeah, the glory days of The Independent were kind of before we were born, really, because I think it was founded in 84.
Yeah, it was like mid-80s, in the middle of Thatcher.
Maybe when you were young and I was yet to be born. But not that much older than me. But yeah, I think even by the time that we actually got round to reading it, it was a shadow of its former self in that sense. But yeah, it definitely is now. I don't. I mean, to get to the wide point, I think that people who say that it is a problem that a couple of people own all of the newsprint media are right, basically, mm-hmm. because in this country, the BBC still takes a lot of its cues from what stories the major newspapers are running.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have like the papers today where everybody sits down on a ugly coffee table and points at their highlighted story.
And it, you know, every so often the Daily Mail will get somebody fired mm-hmm. in the government, which mm-hmm. is not nothing, I think.
That's power.
I mean, it's more influence, but yeah, I mean, it is, it's heft, you know. Mm-hmm. And I don't think the BBC obviously doesn't go in for that kind of campaigning journalism. Or if it does, it sort of does it by accident and then has to frantically reverse out of the situation. But mm-hmm. yeah, I think it is bad. I don't think, as you said, I don't think the eye is going to turn into like Daily Mail Light and thing. It will continue to cater to its audience, but newspapers, you know, you read Private Eye just as I do. Newspapers mm-hmm. regularly do not run negative stories about stuff that concerns their owners.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it would just be better if more people owned like different newspapers. The argument against this position is that you can save money by owning a lot of newspapers because mm-hmm. you can use the same printing presses and all.
Oh, sure, yeah. Oh, that makes sense.
But
then are they still actually? I mean, you've just talked about how the Daily Mail has. Like is still able to unthrone people from positions of power, but this is such a generic and like wanky question. But in a day of like Twitter and social media and like Facebook and Google and YouTube and all of that kind of stuff, is there still a place for something like the Eye? Who read the Eye? You have to get past like 3 different ads that you click out of before you can actually read anything on it.
You're talking about The Independent.
Yeah.
On the Eye.
Not Private Eye.
Yes. Yeah, but The Independent is a separate publication to The Eye now. Like
that. Right, yeah.
So
yeah.
Like The Independent is still owned by the same company that owns The Independent. Which is actually is owned ultimately by like a Russian bit like millionaire
sure.
who used
to work for
the KGB or mm-hmm, mm-hmm. has links, allegedly. I didn't say anything.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, it's... I forgot what your question was.
Why do they matter? Yeah, what's the point?
I don't think the Eye particularly matters, but I still think the, you know, somebody has to actually fund news gathering at the end of the day. And so, yeah, we all get, like... I mean, if you're a political junkie, you get a lot of news and information off of Twitter. But most people aren't. Like, most people don't follow politics that closely. And
was it 7% of the UK's population are on Twitter?
It's quite low, mm-hmm. And bear in mind that, you know, a lot of people are not using Twitter to follow like political news anyway, mm-hmm. or like, you know, important stories that aren't just sporting news. No offense to sport, but yeah, I mean, I in many ways, I don't really see what the future is for like newspapers.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that there's going to be any new newspapers? There's a New European, which is a paper that is fun.
I think that is profitable because they launched that. I can't remember who owns that, but they launched that as an experiment, and it is basically a Ramona newspaper.
Oh, I love it!
But it has a bit, like I think it in some ways it is a bit crap, and that's not just a political thing. But it does have like a strong identity. It's a bit more like a magazine, really. It's not a newspaper. It happens to be printed.
It's on newspaper print. It looks like it, but it doesn't
It's all features, really, mm-hmm. Which is fine. But yeah, I don't. You know, there's. I think the market in the future will be much more towards like very targeted news services. So there's a site that launched recently called The Athletic, and they actually went around and hired loads of journalists from newspapers, sports journalists, and you pay like a fiver a month, I think it is, and it's like all sporting news and that sort of thing. And bearing in mind the number of, I mean, you know. If I read a newspaper, I tend to read it for like the political coverage and some of the foreign affairs and maybe the odd business story here and there, but I'm not there for most of what they provide. So mm-hmm, why would I mm-hmm. want to pay for all of it?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's what I see it much more as like channels and niche things rather than the broad coverage you get in a newspaper, which in some ways is bad, I guess, as a reader, but is more efficient.
Do you think we'd ever have a world where The Guardian wasn't independent or was bought by somebody?
Not in the case of The Guardian, really. Mm. I mean, Because The Guardian's owned by a charity.
Yeah,
and
the Guardian only, Media Trust.
The purpose of that charity is to
further The Guardian.
Further The Guardian in theory, but further liberal values in like, you know, a general sense. That it's called the Scott Trust. And, you know, I can't really... I guess I can see a scenario where, like, the trust goes tits up and then the asset is sold off to somebody to try and pay whatever debts are left. I think that would be a shame, though, because I think that would massively alter the character of The Guardian. You know, which isn't a paper I love all the time, but I think it serves a fairly unique function in British news.
It's very good video journalism.
The Anywhere But Westminster videos are great.
Yeah, those are brilliant. They're the only thing I like at the moment.
I would pay a subscription just to watch those videos.
One of the things I kind of hate about newspaper websites, especially at the moment, is kind of like the equivalent of Guardian is Free, that I think was generally popularised by the Huffington Post, where they would just get anybody to write an article about something. And it made you feel very official. But that person is just somebody with opinion. It's basically a long tweet. And it sits underneath the banner of Guardian or The Independent or even like The Times or The Telegraph, but is just some tit with an opinion.
But what's a columnist if not just some tit with an opinion?
That's a very good point.
I'm not being overly snarky here, but
it's a really good point. I read, we've talked about this. When you read, like, a column of somebody who's writing about a topic that you actually know about, you're like, you don't understand any of this. You've just been, it's like, give me 500 words.
Yeah, I mean, that is something that everyone should do at some point. If you understand a topic really well, go and find a newspaper article about it, and you'll see that, because journalists are generalists, and this is all, like, fairly obvious stuff, but...
think it necessarily is. We don't get to all that.
I guess so. I suppose that's the thing, is that a lot of, it feels to some extent like a lot of newspapers' online offerings are kind of fixated around their columnists, and a lot of it is very opinion driven, which I don't necessarily have a problem with, but, you know, it does divert attention away from, you know, slightly more objective reporting. And, you know, because it's very easy to churn out 500 words of someone's opinion on something, but it's much harder to actually fund proper, like, what I see as proper journalism, which is reporting. I don't know. I mean, the thing is, in the lot, like, there are some newspapers, like The Times apparently is profitable now because they've diverted their attention to their online content. So there are some newspapers that I think that will become sustainable. But you've already seen like a narrowing down of options. Like The Independent is no longer a paper newspaper; it's just online. And you know, in the next 20 years, it's very conceivable that like a major newspaper could fold and never be seen again. So, given that, you know, companies like the one you work for are stealing all the advertising revenue.
I don't know what you're talking about. I'm an independent content creator.
Okay.
What would you say to the description of... Or like, would you go and see a show, perhaps, that is described as an event that is the place of destruction of public taste and where there are screaming transvestites and bearded women? Would you perhaps... go to said event, watch
exciting.
Said event.
Yeah, I would say so.
Excellent. Well, for some reason, these were reasons given against Hungary being in the Eurovision Song Contest. I can't understand why. So Viktor Orban's Hungary has decided to pull out of the Eurovision Song Contest because it's too gay.
I like the framing of too gay.
Yeah.
I said this to you before we started recording, but it does imply that
there is an acceptable level of gay. Yeah, and so, I do sometimes wonder where that is. It's like, don't mind if they're gay, but just don't rub it in my face and keep it away from the children. So it does kind of like this is something that we see in a lot of, especially like Central and Eastern Europe, there is a rise of homophobia. Chechnya in Russia is probably the most extreme version of this, where gay people are being kind of like arrested and murdered. Sorry to bring the tone down. We were talking about the Eurovision. But there is kind of like this desire across a lot of, like, from Poland, including, and like seeing the rise of the AfD in Germany. I mean, even like the Front National in France, who are much more socially conservative, and that social conservatism bleeds out into critique and an intolerance of LGBT people. Mm. We even see it in this country, for goodness sake, every morning when Piers fucking Morgan opens his mouth and talks about trans people and says that he identifies as a fucking penguin.
I feel the trans issue is distinct from the tolerance of homosexuality, though, because this country is very tolerant of homosexuality compared to, say, actually compared to the rest of Europe. All these measurements are kind of relative. Like, you know, there is obviously still there probably always will be some homophobia in this country and everywhere.
But, let's hope so. It keeps things spicy.
But yeah, generally speaking, this, you know. I feel like I'm defending Piers Morgan.
But no, but there is kind of like, it manifests in loads of different ways, but there is this pining for, it's the nostalgia thing. It's the take back control. It's the desire for stuff to be like it used to be, where everybody knew their place and everybody knew their job and their role and the order of things. And I think that very often gay people and trans people are seen as something that threatens that, especially when it's lots of, oh, won't you think of the children, because seeing a rainbow might turn them to faggotry.
It is in some ways the same argument that people made regarding the teaching about homosexuality in schools.
Section 28 in the UK.
So, well, Section 28, but also the more recent protests in
Birmingham. Oh, in Birmingham, yeah.
It is that thing of, I just remember reading this quote somewhere from one dad who was like, he went to some kind of like play or something where there was a gay character or something, and it wasn't a play, it was a concert.
Mm-hmm.
But he was like, I just wanted the opportunity to sort of...
Was it a Years and Years concert?
I don't know.
Because then that's your fault for not knowing that.
He wanted to introduce his son to homosexuality, like, in his own way, or, like, he didn't want it just sprung on him randomly, but...
He wanted to have a nice run-up to the conversation.
I think it's more that, you know, we're going to be very uncharitable to these sort of people, but it's more that...
Fairly.
It's more the father, like, wanted, you know, it was his uncomfortable, like, thing. It wasn't the kid, because mm-hmm, kids don't mm-hmm. really care. About,
yeah, kids, you know, don't care. Kind
of mm-hmm. pretty blasé about stuff. If, you know, if everyone's acting as though it's normal, then kids will just go, oh, okay, well, this is obviously fine.
Mm-hmm.
Generally speaking.
You don't like the Eurovision Song Contest.
Yes, for very different reasons from
your
gay flotilla man.
You like it because you think the music's bad, and that's wrong. But it's okay, you're wrong about multiple things.
The thing is, you keep like baiting me into commenting on Eurovision, and actually, I'm fine with Eurovision existing, I just don't want to participate in it.
Oh, that sounds very similar to Viktor Orban's views on homosexuality, actually. It's like, you can have your Eurovision, but not near me.
I know, I mean, you know, but...
Very close-minded.
I'm not saying that, you know, you can't, Eurovision people can't, like, go walk down
Eurovision
the street.
Eurovision people can't walk down the street.
Walk down the street proclaiming their love for Eurovision. They can do that if they want to. That's fine. I'm not saying they should be hidden away in a closet somewhere. I'm just saying, it's like, you know, if you don't like gay marriage, you don't have to have one. It's like the same logic as that. But mm-hmm. other people can have them. That's fine. I'm so on the defensive now. This is not fair.
It's really curious to me how Russia is a country that continues to have one of the worst records of LGBT rights in Eurovision competing nations.
We're
seeing that as a bloc now. But continues to participate quite a lot. They actually boycotted the contest a couple of years ago because of the, like, it's the Ukraine Russia thing is actually a bigger thing on that radar than the homosexuality thing, which is curious. There have been loads of protests subtle protests within the contest around Russia's entry. So people holding up rainbow flags at particular cuts to the audience and stuff like that when Russia play and things like along those lines.
The fact that Russia's still in it implies that they're happy with the level of gay.
Yeah, a bearded drag queen singing like a mock Bond theme is fine. I have noticed though, like, the Eurovision's always been pretty fucking gay. We had a trans winner from Israel win in 1997. We've had a Ukrainian drag queen with a star on her head. The winner last year was a bi man from the Netherlands. We have great declarations and points of pride from host countries around their track record on LGBT rights, openly gay hosts talking about their partners. It's wonderful. The whole thing's queer as fuck. And that's one of the reasons I love it, is that because the queers love kitsch, we just latched onto it. And the EBU, the European Broadcasting Union, it took a while for rainbow flags to be allowed in where the broadcast actually takes place, but they are allowed there, and it's seen as kind of like this great queer space no matter where it's being held. There are gay people in Hungary who are going to
you're wrong about that.
No, there are.
There's not a single one.
There are, though. And these kind of like, and especially for mainland European and from smaller countries, queer people, the Eurovision really is our Christmas. And it's a shame that Hungary isn't going to get that kind of like this year, but they'll still bloody watch it, and it will still be broadcast, and they'll still find a way to like take part in it. It's my favourite part of being a European gay person. It really is.
This topic has just evolved into an opportunity for you to express your own love for Eurovision.
Yeah, Jimmy, it was always going to be that.
I know. Mm-hmm. Is that? Do you? I mean, this is sort of in prediction territory, but is this something that we're going to see more of with those, let's say, slightly more conservative countries in Europe pulling out of these kind of things?
Yeah, I mean, there has been talk of it, actually, of Russia leaving the EBU and starting its own Eurovision Song Contest.
But a very straight Eurovision.
But song, a straight-o-vision contest.
That'd be rubbish.
It would be shit, wouldn't it?
It'd be like death metal.
Yeah.
Which has actually happened at Eurovision.
Yeah, some women singing ballads. That's what it would be. Ironically, Russia has sent some of the gayest stuff to Eurovision. Like the guy who sang like a really sad ballad while somebody ice skated around him in a leotard.
Yeah.
It was quite wonderful. Also, Sergei Lazarev is probably one of the most flamboyant people to ever represent a nation on the international stage. Yeah. He's got very good abs, Jimmy.
But Russia has like a history of, so Russia's not part of the EU, but it has its own like political grouping, which is basically just it and some old Soviet countries like Kazakhstan and that sort of thing.
Belarus
Russia does its own thing because nobody likes them. Like, it's more of a problem for the idea of Europeanness, which is partly what Eurovision's about, if it is countries within the EU on its eastern flank, like Poland and Hungary, and is Slovakia in the EU? I guess it is. Possibly.
Yes. Question mark.
Yes, I'll go with yes. That's more of a problem, because then you get that divide between, it's like the open-closed thing, but in microcosm you have the more closed nations, which apparently includes Hungary, and against the more open ones, which would include, you know, places like Germany and France and that sort of thing.
Slovakia has been a member of the EU since 2004.
There you go.
You're welcome.
So yeah, it is. It is just part of this story of like Viktor Orban's taking over institutions and undermining the independence.
And I think it is something that we're going to see a lot more of, in terms of the restrictions of and erosions of LGBT acceptance and rights. And I don't know what we can do other than get them over here, to be completely honest. Because, like, the cat is out of the bag. People have come out. And if these nations go backwards and those rights are restricted, you can't put somebody back in the closet. Everybody knows now.
Yeah.
And that is quite scary for them. Yeah, and I don't know what the kind of like the future holds for that.
Well, the EU more generally has sort of threatened sanctions against like Poland for the behaviour of its government, like restriction of the independence of their court system and that sort of thing. I mean, you know, this is I'm not saying they're going to take action against Hungary because of pulling out of Eurovision, but
maybe they should.
If it is part of that overall trend, you know, the EU, in you know, and the slightly more liberal side of Europe, does look a bit impotent if all it can do is stand there and go, ah, you know, as people flout the norms that it's trying to push.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. Okay.
Yeah. On that note.
On that note, what norms are you going to try and push, Jimmy? The following of us on Twitter. Yes, that's what.
That's very abnormal behaviour, judging by the
numbers.
Yeah.
You can follow me at JazzaJohn.
You can follow me at JDE Nichols. Jazza is available on all social media platforms like a good internet boy. I'm only available on Twitter.
My God, I'm going to get merch with good internet boy on it now. and yeah, leave us a review. Okay, is that enough?
That is enough.
Right, bye. Oh, we'll talk about the election next time. Promise.